Welcome back to In the Moment. The Keystone XL pipeline has a long history for something that, so far, does not exist. Its future has not been decided. South Dakota's Public Utilities Commission first permitted the pipeline to cut diagonally across the western half of the state in 2010, but TransCanada did not complete the project within 4 years, and so state law required the company to make assurances that it could still meet the requirements of the permit. In a 9-day hearing held in late July and early August 2015, opponents and proponents laid out their arguments before the PUC at an administrative hearing. In January 2016, the PUC issued a ruling that TransCanada had met its burden. About a month later, opponents filed an appeal. That appeal was heard yesterday in a peer courtroom. Both opponents and proponents know that the fate of the pipeline has never hinged entirely on permission from South Dakota. It also requires a presidential permit. And this most recent election has flipped the pipeline's fate. SDPB's Victoria Wicks traveled to Peer for the hearing and to talk with some of the people who have invested their time and their hopes in a final decision that just doesn't seem to come easily.
KXL is absolutely stimulating. This case has raised issues surrounding the President of the United States, the well-being of the planet, the doctrine of discovery, the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1851, the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868.
Adam DeHewick is a lawyer for the Public Utilities Commission. He sits at the table with the TransCanada attorneys, and over the objection of the lawyers for pipeline opponents, he reads a long statement on behalf of the PUC.
There is no denying that pipelines have sparked considerable public controversy, bringing national attention to issues that include tribal sovereignty and environmental protection. Yet, incredibly, this case involves only one easy-to-read law written by the South Dakota legislature in 1977.
DeHewick refers to the law requiring certification if a permitted project is not completed within 4 years. He points out that this rarely used law has gone unchallenged until now. In legal terms, that makes this case a matter of first impression. One of the opponents or interveners is Bob Goff with IQU. He doesn't agree with DeHewick that the South Dakota law is so simple. He says it has implications far into the future.
The Intertribal Council on Utility Policy sought to address this because, one, we saw that the law that allowed for recertification is a forever stamp. After 4 years, you have to recertify once, and then we don't know what happened. There's nothing in the law that says after a second 4 years.
Goff says the statute could be read as granting an open-ended permit once that first certification is made. He does agree with DeHewick that this hearing is important because no court has examined this statute before. Goff tells Sixth Circuit Judge John Brown that the state has to ensure that the conditions TransCanada follows will work, not just today, but also into the future. To that end, he says he tried to raise a point in the 2015 hearings.
And that was climate. I pause because every time I've said climate in this company, I've been objected to.
National experts on climate change had planned to testify in 2015 to talk about the effects of the project on global warming and the effects of climate change on the pipeline's stability. But over the objections of TransCanada, these experts were not allowed. And Goff notes that climate change was not a consideration in the original permit conditions set out in 2009 and 10.
And the irony is they failed to get a presidential permit from the previous administration because of climate.
TransCanada attorney William Taylor confirms Goff's statement.
President Obama denied the presidential permit, and he did so not on the grounds that the pipeline was not in the national interest, that it didn't afford energy security to the United States. He did it on the grounds that
Judge Brown interrupts to suggest that national interest might include treaty obligations or global leadership, and Taylor agrees and continues.
But if you read Secretary Kerry's recommendation, his decision is made on the basis of his decision was it sent the wrong signal to the rest of the world with respect to our views as to global warming.
Presidential approval is required because the pipeline comes down from Canada, crossing an international border. Taylor says the PUC required Keystone XL to receive all other necessary permits. He says TransCanada applied for the federal permit but did not get an answer until after going through the 2015 certification hearing in South Dakota. Taylor says after President Obama's decision was released, TransCanada announced publicly that it was still committed to the project.
We said in a hearing conducted before the PUC, when asked, well, what are you going to do? We said we're going to wait for another president, and we did. And another president came, and that president, on January 24th, invited a reapplication, and on January 26th, we reapplied. And the executive order inviting the reapplication says that the State Department has 60 days in which to make a decision. Our application was filed on January 26th and is currently in process.
Landowners whose property is on KXL's proposed route took heart when the Obama administration turned down the pipeline. But when Donald Trump was elected in November...
It's really amazing how much things can change and just, you know, elect a new president and stuff. I mean, I had it in my mind that it was done and over with.
Paul Siemens is one of the two most persistent landowners battling Keystone XL in South Dakota.
I would have never guessed that Trump was going to be in there or a Republican president. I just assumed that with the Keystone XL permit denied, I figured the economic realities would eventually kill any idea of a Keystone XL pipeline.
Well, they're going to do their best to do what they've done all along in South Dakota and throughout the nation.
John Harder is the other persistent landowner, although he allows he might be called stubborn. He says after the pipeline project was denied on the national level, he experienced sudden calm. Now the stress has returned.
They're going to use false facts to propagate why we need this pipeline when it's not a need. This is a want. It's always been a want.
Harder says pipeline proponents have projected inflated numbers of jobs the pipeline will create and have not taken into consideration the cost to landowners. And he says there's no guarantee the oil will be used in the United States.
There's a fact of, in common sense, that we need pipelines to carry petroleum products. But, you know, this Keystone XL and Keystone One, these are all export pipelines.
Paul Siemens and John Harder are among protesters who gather outside the Hughes County Courthouse before the hearing starts. Inside the courthouse, it is all about the lawyers. On the courthouse lawn, it's the alliance of cowboys and Indians who have characterized this battle. The tribal members are in the majority at the small gathering outside. Legislators Kevin Killer and Troy Heinert stop by, taking a break from the Capitol just a few blocks away. They give short speeches before returning to their duties. Brandon Sazu is here. He's the chairman of the Crow Creek Tribe. He says he went to North Dakota to protest the Dakota Access Pipeline and was arrested. He's still facing charges. In jail, he met a journalist who had also been arrested. Sazu says he's committed to relying on tenets of democracy rather than violence.
Yeah, we don't use bullets. I mean, the only ones who use bullets are the police or all the military people. I mean, we use our voices, we use our hearts, we use the Constitution of the United States, the freedom of speech, the right to assemble.
One of the constant arguments of First People is that treaties give them certain rights over land, even if that land is no longer contained within reservations. Sazu is emphatic in defending those beliefs.
First and foremost, the supreme law of the land is the treaties. The government forced those treaties upon us, so we rely on those treaties. We follow those treaties. It's the government that doesn't follow those treaties.
Standing with Brian Sazu is Remy Bald Eagle, Intergovernmental Affairs Coordinator with the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. He tells why he made the trip to the courthouse.
At the hearing here today, we have an opportunity to express our opposition and to remind the decision makers here in South Dakota that the interests of the lawmakers and the decision makers here in South Dakota should be for the people of South Dakota, for the land of South Dakota, for the water of South Dakota, but more importantly, for the children of South Dakota.
The decision maker on this day is Judge John Brown, who says he'll deliberate before releasing his decision. He has a number of options, including upholding the PUC's affirmation of TransCanada's permit or sending the issue back to the PUC for reconsideration. The judge's decision, whatever it is, could be appealed to the state Supreme Court, just as a presidential permit faces potential litigation. The lawyers at the hearing talked of delays that could take years. And following those delays is continuing national attention, with protests and headlines and possibly arrests. As Adam DeHewick says, it is absolutely stimulating. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Victoria Wicks, reporting from Pierre.